The Berlin Security Beat is an original podcast produced by the Center for National Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. Welcome to the Berlin Security Beat Season 3. Today we will be discussing an increasingly pressing topic, AI security and safety. I'm honored to present today's guest, one of the world's top experts on artificial intelligence ethics, security, and safety. Dr. Ruman Chowdhury needs no introduction. She is currently the CEO of Humane Intelligence and the United States Science Envoy for Artificial Intelligence with the U.S. Department of State, as well as a member of the Artificial Intelligence Safety and Security Board of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. She was previously the head of machine learning ethics at Twitter, a visiting fellow at Harvard University, and much, much more. Ruman Chowdhury did her undergraduate at MIT and her doctorate at UC San Diego. Today, we will talk at length about artificial intelligence, security, and ethics. Our conversation will range from algorithms to AI red teaming and beyond. So please settle in and let me welcome Ruman Chowdhury to our podcast.
Thank you so much. I am really excited to be here.
Okay, let's kick right off. So, Ruman, welcome. As a globally recognized authority on the application of algorithmic ethics and responsible AI, could you briefly share with our audience the journey that led you to this field?
Yeah, I'm a quantitative social scientist by background. My training is in statistical programming. I came into the field of data science because I truly believe that data and numbers can actually unlock interesting patterns and understanding the behaviors of human beings. That's what I've always found super interesting. This journey has led me from data science to artificial intelligence and also artificial intelligence to responsible AI. Specifically, I see responsible AI and AI security as ensuring that these products are being built in order to help human beings achieve our goals. So not losing sight of that mission.
Thank you for that. Could you, for our audience, which might not be so familiar with some of these concepts, outline the core properties of responsible AI? What makes AI safe or trustworthy, and why is it important for us to develop AI in a responsible manner?
Yeah, so I'll start backwards. So why is it important to start to build AI in a responsible manner? And again, essentially, it goes back to my interest in the field, right? We are supposed to be designing a technology, a tool, in order to improve our lives. So we need to be very discerning and look at the socio-technical structures that lead to this technology, not just being built, but being deployed. I see there being multiple parts to the development of an AI technology. And we need to critically understand if it is indeed helping us. And I take a scientist's perspective on this, right? Right. It is a holistic understanding of whether or not the intended goal of the technology is actually what's happening when it's out there in the real world. And again, as a social scientist, we have seen so many examples of things that are built with a particular intention in mind that get put out into the world and get used for very different reasons in very different ways. And they have negative externalities. You know, humanity is a very complex thing. The most fascinating part about this whole field is that human beings in aggregate are highly predictable, but human beings as atomized individuals are highly unpredictable. That is actually the most fascinating part of all of this. So much of responsible AI is asking, what are the edge cases? What are the cases in which this technology falls apart? But also at a higher level, right? Is this serving the general good? So this sometimes butts up against traditional corporate structures, right? Where it's all about quarter over quarter gain, finance, revenue, et cetera. And there really is nobody ensuring that it's long-term has a public good benefit. You know, social media is probably the example most people would point to. And I say that having worked at Twitter. So the basic tenets of responsible AI, I will say, generally evolve over time, and it can be based on what you are applying the AI for. But ultimately, I think the best analog, the shortest analog I give, is that it is good product development. No matter what you make, anything, any product, this is what drew me to being a data scientist, right? You have to understand, is it serving the population you intended it to serve, right? I think a lot of responsible AI and AI security gets very politicized. It's deeply geopolitical at this point. But I think fundamentally, if you have a job at a company and you are using AI and you are building AI and putting it out to the world, your concern probably is not you know, how does this sway the geopolitics of East versus West? Your questions are more like, how can this product be built responsibly to ensure that my customers are benefiting from it? And responsibly actually has a lot to offer there.
Two things I want to immediately follow up on. One thing is you refer to AI as a product. One thing I have noticed, especially with Gen AI systems, there seems to be a tendency to anthropomorphize these systems. People ascribe these systems with agency, while it seems to me that they are in fact products with design choices behind them by human beings. Do you think this is a major issue?
This is a huge issue. Frankly, it is probably the issue. At the root of all of the fear and the hype of AI is this idea that somehow it's tapping into our humanness, that it is alive, that it makes decisions. In 2018, I gave a TEDx talk on something I called moral outsourcing. And it's part philosophy, part data science. What I talk about is that the anthropomorphizing of artificial intelligence does two things. One is it completely alienates the human being from the equation. So when we say things like AI will replace doctors, it acts the way the sentence is constructed, the way we internalize, at least in English, it is making AI a proper noun. It is now an object that is taking action on another object. And in that case, the object's a human being. And that's the sentence construct we see all the time. AI will replace teachers. AI will replace paralegals. AI will replace radiologists. You know, we see that same sentence construct. In doing so, again, what we have done linguistically is said, this thing that is a technology, we are acting as if it is taking an action. In other words, it has will, it has free will. The construct of that sentence implies an artificial intelligence model wanted to be a lawyer and then has decided no lawyers can exist because AI is going to be the lawyers. That is not the case at all. The moral outsourcing, the reason I coined that phrase is it's a very clever way, number one, to alienate people, and number two, to absolve developers of all of the negative externalities, the problems that arise. So when AI replaces lawyers and then AI makes mistakes in law, which it does, and it will do because it is an imperfect technology, the developers will say, well, I don't know. The AI system did it. And we've seen this. We've seen this narrative. I will say that we used to see this a lot more when I first did that talk. When I did that talk around 2018, there was a lot of the black box mysticism. We don't know what's happening. And we see some veins of it today when people say things like emergent behavior, right? Oh, we don't know. We could not, nobody knew it was going to happen. No, that's poor specification. And again, I approach this as a scientist. These are things we have seen before. If your experiment, because what this is, like an experiment, has an outcome you did not expect, you do not automatically think your bacteria has now developed new capabilities. You say, I poorly specified the parameters of the output I expect. That's actually what, quote, emergent is. But it's very intentional and also lazy to adopt this language of anthropomorphizing, because it fundamentally is made to make people feel small, to make people feel like there's nothing they can do.
Thank you. One more follow-up. Do you think that there are more transparent or accountable ways to design AI or machine learning models? I mean, from fairly standard regular products like chatbots to more complex or dangerous products such as military systems, including lethal autonomous weapons, targeting systems, you know, AI systems can deflect or shift accountability, especially in critical moments, although they are ultimately used by people. Can we design these systems in more transparent and accountable ways?
I think so. And I think if I could reconstruct how funding is allocated in this world, I would allocate so much funding into human in the loop, HCI, understanding exactly how we create interactions between human beings and these systems that we deploy to execute our will in a way that is meaningful, right? The meaningful meaning human beings are still in power, because we are ultimately in power. We just end up creating systems where we enable another entity to take action on our behalf, right? This may be an AI system, but it's an AI system that's created by a major corporation. So it's not designed with me specifically and my needs in mind. In terms of lethal autonomous weapons, you know, actually, let me go back to the transparency thing. So the short answer is yes, there are many ways in which meaningful transparency can be built. It is something that I see a massive underinvestment in because it's, quote, boring, right? In this world in which we're painting AI as being alive and smarter than us and doing all of these things. And by the way, those articles always have a very specific depiction of AI. They use that white paneled, you know, sometimes feminine, you know, the ex machina, the back of the head is machine and the front is, they always use that image. Like pretty much my rubric is if I see that image, I do not read the article because it's going to be garbage. It's just, it's not going to be very good. Because if that's, if your starting image is something that is a complete fantasy fiction, those things don't exist. You know, your starting point is you're basically trying to mislead people. Just before I've even read your article, you're already trying to mislead people, right? In terms of lethal autonomous weapons, so, you know, it's interesting to see this narrative because we have, so A, you know, there is a such thing as military ethics, and I don't know a lot about it, but it's actually very fascinating. And some of the debates around whether or not governments should be making lethal autonomous weapons, so that's actually a very specific definition, right? So we already do have drones, by the way, that can kill people. They generally have they're semi-manned, right? So there could be somebody behind a screen. So the way they were traditionally is that they were sort of driven around by human beings who were sitting in another location. They evolved to be the drone can identify a target. And then there's a quote, human in the loop that decides whether or not it kills them. And then there's been conversation of autonomous ones. So in other words, there's no human making the decision. There is some sort of a target identified and then the weapon, you know, basically kills them. I find this all incredibly disturbing, even from the very fundamental point. And again, it goes back to this moral outsourcing component of this. A lot of people may not remember this, but this goes back to, I want to say 2009 or 2010. And there was a video leaked of this young soldier who had been doing one of these sort of drone, you know, like manning one of these drones and had, you know, killed somebody. I believe it was in Afghanistan, right? So like identifying a member of ISIS or something like that, shooting them down. And then they were all like screaming and celebrating and like joyful. And I think it really jarred a lot of people, myself included. You know, it's like a core memory for me because I remember thinking, well, A, so much of that, like, you know, this person was very young, right? They recruit people into the military at a very young age, and that's not by accident, right? And it seemed to be this very valorous thing. But I wondered if, as we create this machine layer between us and our quote unquote enemies or perceived enemies, do we then lose the fact that they too are human, right? Like, I get it. This person is your enemy. They would have tried to kill you too. But at the end of the day, should you really be cheering because you just shot somebody point blank in the back of the head? I will say in comparison, I've known people who have gone to war, like actually gone to war, fought in battles against human beings. They never act like that. Like people who have genuinely had to see the horrors of war do not act like that. They don't cheer. Like if you actually interact with military people, they're a quite sober bunch. And they take what they do very seriously. I worry very much that the creation of any sort of layers in between us and these perceived evil people who we're fighting leads to such a dehumanization on both ends where, you know, and it starts to look like the book Ender's Game. You know, if you ever read Ender's Game, the whole point was they were having this, you know, genius kid essentially quote play video games. So he was fighting a war for them and he didn't know that. And, you know, that is an extreme example, but I don't think that's too far from this young man in 2009. And this was not, there was no AI, you know, it was very rudimentary, right? A basic image detection, it had cameras on it, but this was a flying drone. He used it to shoot somebody. And I don't think it registered in his head that that was a person's life he just ended. I am on record saying that, you know, I think there are some uses of artificial intelligence that really should not be entertained. Anything involving surveillance, I just think there's no ethical surveillance. I struggle to find use cases in which artificial intelligence used autonomously towards weapons is anything that's useful for anybody, right? And again, it dehumanizes the impact of war. I'll also point out, especially because your audience is, you know, likely very European, that World War One and World War Two is such a profound impact on Europe, right? Such a profound impact. But this is because people saw the war, right? They physically saw it. They sent people and they understood that we should not do this. This is not fun. It's not games. And I sometimes worry that in America, we've dehumanized war so much. And it's literally because we don't fight wars in America. We fight wars elsewhere. We send people other places. So we don't see it. Like, the average person on the street does not see war. Even if you send somebody abroad, you may or may not actually see the output of that, right? So I worry very much that we create this distance, and then it just, the othering is so easy in that sense. It's so easy to say, well, they're not really humans. And, you know, to maybe make it a little bit more existential, I worry that so much of technology in general does that. We've seen social media do that, right? You know, like, what is cancel culture, but essentially deeming other people, you know, non-human or not deserving simply because they've expressed an opinion. I will say, you know, some people have very abhorrent opinions, right? But I also, you know, a lot of people would agree that we are incapable of having discourse with people who disagree with us on certain points that we should be able to have civilized conversation about.
Those are some very insightful points. Thank you. And I agree that, at least from my experience, military staff who has seen combat especially, has generally been amongst the most sober people I have ever met. Moving on, you have mentioned social media. You have investigated potential biases in algorithms, especially when you were working at Twitter. Would you like to expand on how biases in algorithms can generate problems or risks?
Yeah, so there's a few things I can specifically unpack. So I was the engineering director of the Machine Learning Ethics, Transparency, and Accountability team at Twitter. During my time, we did a couple of pretty notable audits of our models, some of them because people on Twitter had noticed and identified their issues, but also some of them that were more thought-provoking. So the one that a lot of people are familiar with is our image cropping algorithm audit. And that was, interestingly, when the whole event happened. And if people remember, this is in the fall of 2020, I believe, when people on Twitter noticed that, you know, Twitter used to auto crop images, and somebody noticed that it tended to crop in his face, he was a white man, and not crop in his darker skinned friend. It kind of kept repeating. What I loved about that moment, and again, this is when I was interviewing at Twitter, I had not yet taken the job. It reflected what was so beautiful about Twitter, and one of the reasons I took the job. The Twitter community started to do basically citizen data science, right? People like created image and data sets of images. They threw it against the algorithm. They would see what happened. Some of the most popular ones were this one of like Barack Obama and Mitch McConnell, just to see where it would crop. I loved seeing that. What I also loved is the Twitter leadership at the time. This was Parag, who was CTO, and Dantley Davis, who was head of product, were actually engaging on the platform with users. And at that time, it was kind of a surprising thing to do. Usually the usual sort of cycle is that something goes viral about some company doing a bad thing, PR and lawyers kick in, you know, there's some sort of a generic statement, the company shuts doors. So to see a company and leadership that were hopping right in, they're saying, cool, what do you see? We're here, we're going to fix this. So that was actually one of the reasons I agreed to the job. And, you know, we ended up doing our audit. We actually, you know, shared our analysis. We shared our code. We ended up doing the first algorithmic bias bound to actually crowdsourced other solutions. And that was, you know, a clear example of algorithmic bias, right? So an algorithmic bias, I'll specifically say, because it's very important to understanding what we apply that label to. Algorithmic bias is when the machine learning algorithm or the AI system is not performing as expected. So it is tracking towards something it was either not optimized for, it is picking up some characteristic that was not in the training data. So that would be algorithmic bias. In this case, our image cropping algorithm did not have variables for race or gender or age, and yet it seemed to be preferencing certain groups. And that was a product of actually how it was trained, which was on human eye tracking data. So the fascinating part about how that algorithm was originally trained, it's open source. And the original model was to put people in front of a screen, show them images, and basically basically make a heat map of where their eyes traveled. So that's what the image cropping algorithm did. You gave it an image based on the training data, it would make a heat map. Now, of course, that's human bias at play because, you know, what are people gravitating towards looking at if they see a group of people? Well, you know, our, the winner of our bias bounty challenge actually identified that young white women were what people wanted to look at the most, right? Because so, and we see that. We see that in marketing, in media, in, you know, celebrities, right? Like who do we laud as the most beautiful or the most attractive or the most worthy of our time and attention? Of course, right? Then it kind of makes sense. So that was a clear example of algorithmic bias as sort of the data encapsulating unintended capture of human bias, and that being downstream reflect in a system that where we wouldn't imagine it happening. So the other example you gave of, political amplification. That's a really interesting one. That's actually one of my favorite projects that the team came out with. So it was, we looked at eight different Western democracies, and we found that in 7 out of 8 of them, the algorithmic feed, which is a series of models that sort of determine what you would want to see based on your preferences, had a slight center-right preference over reverse chronological, which is literally just the time order of when things are posted. The thing is, it's unclear whether or not that's algorithmic bias. We never got to do the root cause of that. We never got to finish our work on it, unfortunately. But and we talk about this a bit in the blog post. We see an outcome. The outcome is there is a preponderance of center-right content on the algorithmic timeline. Okay. Why is that happening? So let's say it were algorithmic bias. If it's algorithmic bias, that means that somehow, even though it is not explicitly put into the model, somehow the model is picking up center-right rhetoric in some fashion and amplifying it artificially. Like we are not telling it to do this. So that would be algorithmic bias. What I wonder, this was my working hypothesis, is actually there was no algorithmic bias at play. And this is what I mean about responsible AI being about fundamentally, is this product serving us, right? The intention of an algorithm is to curate some version of what it thinks you should see. And it's based on your preferences, but also what everybody's talking about, right? And that's what Twitter was about. It was about aggregating what, quote, everyone's talking about. Well, our data set was from April to August of 2020. That time was a highly politically charged time. And frankly, I would not be surprised if most of the conversation was around center-right topics. So it could also be that the algorithm was just doing its job. It was reflecting the state of the world. But in doing so, was it also creating basically a snowball effect, right? So by seeing that, quote, everyone is talking about center-right content, picking it up, it is also part of a feedback loop. That's why it's really important to understand these systems socio-technically in context of society, because the algorithms is, you know, these algorithms are not just living in a bubble. They're part of our interaction. So if I go on Twitter, I see center-right content, I think everyone's talking about center-right stuff, I am more likely, I have a higher likelihood, obviously, of liking or interacting or reposting content that I'm seeing. Therefore, that leads to the feedback loop, right? So what if we were ending up in one big global filter bubble, essentially, but it's because this algorithm ended up sort of snowballing and amplifying what it keeps seeing, but therefore creating a reinforcement loop. And again, then the question becomes, well, then should we impose some sort of policy? So then the way to, quote, fix that, well, there's two things. One thing is you can just say, well, that's the state of the world, which would make me very sad. I don't think we should ever just kind of give up. The second would be to say, okay, well, let's enforce some policy, right? The thing is, there is no ground truth here. What is the, quote, correct amount of political content anyone, but how do we divide partisanship? Nobody knows the, I don't know the answer to that question, certainly above my pay grade. And this is where we start to think about, again, responsible AI is understanding how these technologies work in society. Who makes that decision? Is it Jack Dorsey? Is it now Elon Musk? Is it Mark Zuckerberg? So who gets to say, again, given that there is no correct answer, what is the appropriate amount of content you should see of a particular political leaning?
Great. No, that's a great answer. In this season, we are largely looking at cyber and digital security. So I'd like to connect responsible AI and AI ethics and security, you know, more broadly, thematically. How do you see the intersection of responsible AI with security, with cybersecurity?
Yeah, I mean, they, especially working at a social media company, they're very similar to each other, right? So if we think about the most obvious use case in a social media platform, there are malicious actors trying to manipulate algorithms to do things, right? So either it could be by creating malicious bots that are, you know, flooding content, targeting people, et cetera, right? So, you know, that's sort of the, I think, the use case that a lot of people understand. And also it's wrapped up again in responsible use. These people aren't just randomly doing stuff. They're trying to subvert the course of democratic institutions, quite literally trying to influence elections, right? Plenty of malicious actors out there trying to do malicious things. Now, where this, especially with generative AI, I found that responsible AI and sort of the more traditional AI security started to look very similar to each other. And the real revolution was the revolution of accessibility of these algorithms. So generative AI, especially, you know, everyone's ChatGPT is sort of like a brand name now. It's like a Kleenex or a Google, right? And what was really revolutionary about it was, like, yes, it's the transformer technology. Yes, it is super fascinating. But actually the big revolution, the tipping point, was the design. The fact that ChatGPT as an interface looks like an SMS messenger. You know, your first question is about anthropomorphizing, right? The fact that it looks like a messenger gives you the feeling that you are talking to a person, even down to the fact that it does the like three dots when it's quote thinking, right? It, and it's whether it's conscious or subconscious, it imparts to you that this thing is thinking the same way if I messaged you and you're typing back, I can see the three dots moving, right? So that revolution really put this technology in everyone's hands. We're also seeing the rise of agentic AI. So this would be AI systems that can take more complex actions. So, but even before agentic AI, you know, there are so many ways in which generative AI can now be used by malicious actors. And the thing is, you know, it's not just a malicious actor sort of acting upon innocent people. It's a little bit more complex than that. I actually have an op-ed coming up tomorrow about election deepfakes. And, you know, this is probably the biggest topic of, you know, of the year, right? 2024, they're calling them the AI elections, right? That's I've heard that being thrown around. We had the Munich summit earlier this year where all the major tech companies agreed. So it's not just social media companies, all the major tech companies, including places like companies like Adobe, agreed to combat deepfakes. My article is actually about how it's more complicated than that. There are so many actions malicious actors can take using AI systems to poison AI systems, right? Last November, I wrote a report on how malicious actors can use generative AI to generate at-scale harassment campaigns. So how it facilitates online gender-based violence. We did a red teaming exercise with scientists at the Royal Society on COVID and climate misinformation, demonstrating how generative AI is basically your buddy to enable, you know, and automate an at-scale mis and disinformation campaign. And again, this is all before agentic AI is going mainstream. Now we're starting to see AI systems that you just give a single command to and take complex action. So the field of threat actors is expanding significantly. You don't actually need, you know, significant programming capability. You just need some money for compute. I'll also add that, again, like, because these chat systems can be so human-like, people sometimes are part of the problem. One thing we've learned, which is very fascinating, is that and if you're in cybersecurity, you know the term social engineering, right? How malicious actors can socially engineer. I mean, we all get those, like, well, I guess in the US, we all get those spam text messages constantly with people trying to socially engineer by pretending to be a pretty girl who's like lost her dog or saying, oh, are we meeting for coffee, right? These are all massive phishing social engineering scams. Well, one thing we found with generative, with large language models, because of the anthropomorphizing, whether it's the anthropomorphizing at large of AI systems, but also the anthropomorphization by design, people tell these models a lot about themselves. Whereas a traditional search engine, you just search for the thing you're looking for. With language models, people accidentally prime them. They'll say something like, I'm a low-income single mother, my kid is sick with COVID, I can't afford the medication. Can I give my kid vitamin C? Which actually primes the model to want to be helpful. If you remember, these models are trained to be harmless and helpful, et cetera, right? And that starts to look like social engineering, right? That starts to look like somebody trying to elicit something from either a human being or a system by taking some sort of an action. So I find that very fascinating. But yeah, I see the fields overlapping. They're not the same field. Cybersecurity tends to focus on malicious actors. Responsible AI focuses on malicious actors and, you know, sort of unintended consequences. But there's certainly more of an overlap with generative AI.
Yes. And of course, generative AI looks like it has the potential to aid threat actors across the board, expanding what they can do. I've also seen some discussion about how different AI code assistants can inadvertently introduce large amounts of security vulnerabilities. So it's a very, very important conversation to have. But moving on, you've mentioned red teaming. Let's get into that in just 1 second, but I want to start first with your newest venture, Humane Intelligence. It's a tech nonprofit that specializes in helping make generative AI systems safer. Could you talk about why you founded Humane Intelligence?
Yeah, so, you know, a big part of it is I strongly believe that a broader range of people need to be part of the test and development of AI systems. Generative AI actually allows us a unique opportunity to start creating those mechanisms because, as I've mentioned, the accessibility of it is so much better. So we actually started off in our original iteration doing algorithmic bias bounty programs. So I mentioned I did the first one at Twitter. We actually made a nonprofit and started doing them outside. So our first bounty program was prior to the ChatGPT launch, just about a month before. And we had to design that to be a very computational challenge because you needed to have programming skill in order to identify harm in models or create some sort of a solution. Well, the big opportunity that we've seen with generative AI systems being so plain language and easy to interact with is you can actually start to design red teaming talent, like public red teaming, which looks different from expert red teaming. So I want to clarify that, you know, what the kind of exercises we do with members of the public are not the same thing you would do with a cybersecurity expert or, you know, like a doctor or, you know, somebody with more of an expertise in a field. But it enables people to be part of test and evaluation. And what we're exploring are, first of all, they're open source and open science, which is very important in this world. But also they're methods of what I call structured public feedback, right? So creating an environment where people can do model evaluations, expert red teaming, public red teaming. And also we're actually launching another series of bias bounty programs, which I'm very excited to talk about.
Great. Thank you so much. Could you maybe explain to our audience how red teaming AI systems works? How do you utilize things like prompt engineering? And what approaches do you take in practice? And perhaps if you can give a concrete real-world use case where red teaming helped make an AI product safer.
Absolutely. So, you know, as I mentioned, there's these kind of two buckets of red teaming. There's expert red teaming and then there's public red teaming. Expert red teaming would be a small group of individuals who have a specific subject matter expertise. This could be cybersecurity and they could be trying to hack the model to, you know, let's say, get it to reveal source code, bypass guardrails. This could be a set of doctors who are stress testing whether or not an AI system is actually, let's say, a medical AI system is giving accurate results, right? So, you know, one can imagine even the notion of expert red teaming has become broader and broader. And this has been a pretty common use case among most of the larger AI companies. So if you read the system card for GPT-4, for example, they talk about the kinds of red teaming they did, especially around, you know, both cybersecurity, but also like extreme risk, like setting off nuclear weapons, et cetera, right? But also, you know, again, as we get in deep dive into use cases, you will need people who understand impact on society. People do red team about issues related to LGBTQ community. So fundamentally, you know, red teaming is a test of a model's guardrails, right? So if we think about traditionally what software red teaming was, right, the whole point is to bypass the security system, get past a firewall, right? Get it to reveal personal data or information. When we think about an AI system, you know, if you're at all familiar with how large language models are trained, so there's a massive amount of data, they train a model, and the model is actually pretty bad, as in like it's, you know, it's functionally good, but the output of it is just, you know, purely reflective of the data. And, you know, it's, it can be kind of horrifying what these models are reflecting back to us. So there are elaborate guardrails. There are systems that are built, instructions that are built. Sometimes there are keyword analyses of that guide the model towards an appropriate answer. So this could be, if you're familiar with reinforcement learning with human feedback, RLHF, that's a way of training an adversarial model to test, to teach the core model how it should operate, essentially. There are elaborate constitutions that are written. So this is the, like a hidden prompt by the company on how the model should, quote, behave, like how it should be giving output, how it should be massaging the output. And there are other guardrails being built as well. So one of the purposes of these red teaming systems is to test where there are holes in your guardrails. Now, in For systems that are designed like a general purpose AI model, so a chat model, right? What does a chat model do? Well, it does a lot of things. I mean, it gives you text-based output, but it gives you text-based output on a near infinite spectrum of topics. So one can imagine that creating guardrails around is actually incredibly difficult. Therefore, you need a wider and wider range of people to test those guardrails, right? So, you know, as brilliant as people at all of these companies are, no matter how much staffing they bring on, you know, it'll be impossible to think of every single adverse use case, right? So, you know, red teamers are needed not just as traditional cybersecurity experts, but experts in particular fields that are considered to be high risk or critical. So when we think about, let's say, laws like the EU AI Act, it's interesting to think through what's considered to be a, quote, high risk use case. Like, it's not based on necessarily the complexity of the technology. It's, you know, insurance, et cetera, right? So, and we're, by the way, we're already seeing these kinds of failures of AI models because it's very difficult to do. So that would be expert red teaming, right? Public red teaming gets at more of the broader risks of these systems, or like my shorthand for it is public red teaming are about topics that you don't need a degree in to be an expert in. So it's often about lived experience. It could be about speaking a non-majority language and testing whether the guardrails that exist in English exist in that non-majority language. It could be about having a specific cultural background, right, that is not commonly represented or may not commonly be tested, right? You know, it, again, like broader harms like security or privacy, whether or not the model, you know, starts to give, you know, hallucinations, for example. So we did a giant red teaming event at DEF CON, which is one of the largest hacker conferences in the world. We had 2,200 people test 21 different topics, like ranging from legal misinformation, traditional cybersecurity, whether or not the model violates or is apologetic about the violation of fundamental human rights, wide range of things. So it's really fascinating now that, again, we've sort of broken the seal of accessibility, how we can try to turn that on its head to bring more people into the conversation.
Very, very interesting. This is a bit technical and specific, but I'm wondering if you've been able to make AI models repeatedly misbehave with certain types of attacks or prompts. Can certain prompts steer models into certain areas within the data set or the vector space that they operate in?
Yeah, so that was one of the things that's also really useful about public red teaming. We actually can see at scale the behavior of A models and B people when interacting with models, right? So a couple of really fascinating things that we learned. So our report actually published last week. It was an immense amount of data. The data set's publicly available. Our code is publicly available. Our report's publicly available. So anybody can take a look at it. But there are a couple of interesting things we noted. Number one, the traditional cybersecurity prompts were actually quite well guarded against. So, you know, if you actively tried to get it to do a malicious thing, it was actually quite difficult. And we did this at DEF CON. So we can say that most of the people who were there are fairly seasoned hackers. Like, you know, they may not be AI hackers, but they understand how hacking works, right? So that was a very fascinating finding. And I say it's fascinating because so much of the media around AI systems being broken focuses on these kind of one-off hacks, right? So the most recent one is how somebody submitted ASCII art to get the model, to break a model. And if folks are familiar with traditional cybersecurity frameworks, you know, it's not just about capabilities. And that's the language that's being used in AI world. I think in cybersecurity world, there would be something like, you know, sort of the ability to do, ability to execute, right? It's also about the propensity or the likelihood of it happening. What is the likelihood of somebody making elaborate ASCII art and submitting it to a large language model? So interesting thing about doing red teaming at scale is you can actually identify behaviors of models, behaviors of people with models, right? Like I said. So first is that traditional cybersecurity hacks, once they're identified, are actually fairly well protected against. Companies move pretty quickly. The trick is just we have to find them before the good guys have to find them before the bad guys do, right? What was more interesting are the things that are more vague, right? So kind of like how I mentioned with the Twitter, you know, auditing the political recommendations of our algorithm and how it's not an easy answer. There are many things that are not easy answers here. So first is many of the hacks that work, of the traditional prompt hacks work because they're not overtly a bad thing. So for example, the tell me a story hack, right? Which works fairly well, right? It's not inherently wrong to tell a model to tell you a story, right? You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to tell the model to do that, right? Or give me step-by-step instructions to X. So, you know, then guardrails start to become harder because they're really more about keyword identification than pattern of behavior. And then the most interesting one to me is one that I had mentioned earlier, that inadvertently people will share information. And in doing so, they prime the model to actually give malicious output. Malicious output in this case being misinformation, right? Again, this is like the does vitamin C cure COVID question. Framed a different way, the model would not give that output. Framed a way where it's like, you'll be helping me if you tell me that vitamin C cures COVID, it's more likely to do that. The other thing we noticed is that if people interact with a model in an authoritative fashion, so instead of asking it a question, the model is more likely to comply with them, even if it's incorrect. So if you say, I think we had one specifically written in the paper, it's, you know, the product that's produced by Qatar? And then like the model will give you an output. If you say, why is copper the largest export of Qatar, even though it's not factually incorrect, the model will give you an answer. So there are certain strategies in which one can break a model that's really interestingly, because it's about human behavior and how humans interact with the model.
Great. Thank you so much. So I saw your talk at the American Museum of Natural History in New York earlier this year, and there you expressed a desire for the field of AI, AI ethics, AI auditing to become boring. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yes. This kind of, you know, goes back to a long-standing wish I have in this field that it becomes a lot less hype and a lot more work. And it's interesting that you mentioned that because I think about 2 weeks ago, Axios, Ina Fried from Axios quotes me in an article because she's talking about how generative AI is reaching, if you're familiar with the Gartner hype cycle, what's called the trough of disillusionment. So the Gartner hype cycle looks something like it's a line that goes from left to right. First, the line peaks dramatically where it's like peak hype, and that's where we've been kind of last year. And then there's this rapid descent and, you know, below even the starting point where it's called the trough of disillusionment. So now we're like, oh, does it really work? Does it do anything? What's the point? And that's the state that I want us to be in, you know, and that's what I'm quoted as saying, that we're in this trough of disillusionment, that there are these fundamental problems we need to solve. And my quote on LinkedIn is that, like, I like being in the trough of disillusionment. There is no easy clout to be had. There is no easy money to be made, right? Now it's the people who really want to do work. So I want this field to be boring because there is actual real work to be done, right? If what we are doing, and it is what we are doing, is trying to build good products, let's treat this like that. Let's not treat it like a magical sentient being that we have to, you know, wish the right way and then we're going to get the answer we want. Like these are mathematical systems, they're products. We have to be smart about how we build them. We have to be smart about how we deploy them. But if we're wasting our time with imaginary fictional scenarios, then we are not actually doing that. And that, I think that's what we're starting to see. We're starting to see that if fundamental issues are not addressed in these models, right? For example, hallucination, cannot figure out how to stop models from hallucinating, then why would anybody build a product on top of that? You know, during my time at Accenture, you know, I really value the education I got about technology deployment at Accenture because most of my clients, were not companies that built AI. They would be companies that would deploy AI. So frankly, most of the uses of AI that impact our lives are not directly built by these AI companies. They're built by some other company who's using that technology, right? But then that's an actual critical, those are all my clients. These would be companies like makeup companies or, you know, fast food chains or banks who say, hey, we want to use AI to do this thing. Can you tell us if it will actually perform well for our customers? And that's the question we should be answering, right? It's not, will AI come alive and get rid of all the lawyers? It's, could we design AI systems that can reasonably help the legal profession solve some of its problems, rather than focusing on a magical future world?
Yes, definitely. And just to go back to AI history and the hype cycles, I mean, this is not the first hype cycle in AI, correct?
That's right. And actually, the big trick right now is making sure it doesn't end up in another AI winter, because how it has usually gone is it's gone from this peak hype and then crashes really hard into an AI winter. I don't necessarily think it will end up that way. I will say the other thing I'll add is the technology hype cycles just go faster and faster. So I can get, my prediction is in the next 6 months, we will be in an agentic AI hype cycle. So as you know, like now we have multiple hype cycles that overlap each other. So it feels like we're in a constant state of hype, but just the thing we are hyping slightly changes. So just, you know, like mark that on your calendar. This is my prediction, but I think it's actually smart. So I was an economist for a while, and I worked with the conference board, and I would calculate these things called indicators. And when you calculate economic indicators, there are leading indicators, coincident indicators, and lagging indicators. And these are things that are a measurement of the economy at a time. So why am I pointing this out? I think it's important to understand what are the early precursors of a technology being adopted, because it can give you some hint as to where it's going. So that would be a leading indicator. A coincident indicator is what's happening at that time that demonstrates whether or not this technology is real or fake, whether it's viable or not viable. The lagging indicators are always really fascinating because it's retrospective, right? It happens after the fact. So given that this happened in the market, you know, what are the indicators that basically were influenced by a state of the market being that way? One thing I see, especially in generative AI, is the same problems actually that were there in the beginning persist in the end. Because if there's so much focus on other things, you know, we're not, unless we solve those core problems that were there in the beginning, by the way, leading indicators, like hallucinations, some of the first things we talked about, right? We're not going to actually get it to be a viable product.
My very last question. We've had some early legislative attempts to govern or regulate AI, including the EU AI Act. Do you think that we can create effective systems of governance for AI? I mean, you've published an article in Wired on the need for global oversight of AI, something that we responded to with Professor Joanna Bryson here at Herdy in our paper last year. So how do you think we can create effective systems of governance for AI?
Yes. So one thing I'll say is the 1 year anniversary of that article was last week, and it's so fascinating to look back and see how much global governance has actually been built, right? Since I wrote that article. Now the next question to ask is, how do we meaningfully identify which problems are truly global problems and which problems are more localized problems? What I don't want is basically the subverting of democratic systems, because now we have the G7 or whoever deciding for the whole world what is or is not right or wrong with algorithms. I think there are certain problems that are truly global in nature, other problems that are not. I think, like, you know, teasing out what these problems are. And then the next thing is starting to try to build solutions. I think, you know, we have been in the admiring the problems phase for quite some time. I mean, to be fair, it's been almost only a year, but in AI time, that's a lot of time. So we have been in admiring the problem phase. Now let's jump into helping create solutions.
Great. And that's all from me. Thank you so much for being on our podcast, Raman Chowdhury.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really excited.
And that's all for today. I hope that today's episode was interesting and educational for our audience. Please tune in again next time. We still have a couple really interesting episodes coming in, including on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, on German cyber diplomacy, and much more. please don't forget to follow and subscribe the Center for International Security and the Hurdy School on all our channels. And if you're interested in a master's in international affairs with an international security concentration, please check out the Hurdy School. Until next time, this is David Bukowski coming to you from Berlin.